This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Fall of Shannara, Book 2, The Scar Invasion, by Terry Brooks. Read for you by Simon Vance. For Lisa, our beloved daughter, child of nature, taken too soon. 1. Darkon Lee, Arjin said, calm and composed, ignoring the sword at her throat. A look of surprise flickered across Dar's lean features. Arjin sensed he was having trouble comprehending who she was, or, more likely, what she was. She was certain that whomever he had expected to find beneath her war helmet once it was removed, it wasn't a woman. But she was used to such looks. When dressed in full armor, with her dazzling white cloak draped across her shoulders, she presented an unlikely picture. Even now, ragged as she was from the night's battles, she was imposing. She was a woman who fought alongside men as an equal, a woman who led them in battle. In her Scar homeland, she was regarded with awe and reverence. Yet she was also a princess, the only daughter of her nation's ruling family, the firstborn of a king and a queen, a prime birthing, although her mother's replacement, the pretender, as Arjin insisted on calling her, though never to her face, had been quick enough to give him a pair of boy children once the former queen was banished. The pretender would have loved to banish the daughter too, preferably to a burial plot, but Arjin was hard to kill. Just ask Dar-Lee. She waited patiently for him to say something, but he seemed unable to find the words. He simply stood there, staring, with the point of his blade at her throat, and his expression unreadable. "Not what you expected?" she asked. She gave him an encouraging smile, enjoying the moment. "Who are you?" he managed finally. Her smile broadened. She was tall and strong and beautiful. Blonde in the manner of most Scar, her hair curled about her face in tight ringlets, framing startling blue eyes and fair skin. Seeing nothing more, you might still have thought her well-bred and educated, but you would have missed much by looking no further. Only 22 years of age, she was a warrior skilled in combat arts and battlefield tactics. She had been born to it, her talents obvious even at an early age. Realizing the precariousness of her situation with her mother gone and the pretender sitting on the throne with her father, Arjin had quickly decided to reinvent herself. So she had joined the Scar army. She had asked to be called only by her given name and not be accorded any special treatment. She was given none. She was harassed and abused, but she never complained. She was athletic to begin with, and she had refined her natural ability as she'd trained. Her willingness to place herself at risk and to suffer whatever hardships were required had endeared her to the soldiers who supervised her training or trained with her, all of whom were quick to tell others of her commitment. Her father, watching from afar, was one of those who paid attention. Arjin's perseverance, even in the face of her mother's banishment and the animosity of the pretender, only deepened his feelings for her. He was impressed by her determination and skill. She had excelled at everything asked of her, and had evidenced an extraordinary understanding and appreciation of the lessons she was being taught. She advanced quickly through the army's ranks, becoming a battalion commander at 18. For her first assignment, she was tasked with leading a small number of Scar soldiers into an outback country in Eurodia that had risen in revolt. She led from the front. She never asked anything of her soldiers that she would not do herself, and crushed the uprising in 3 days. By then she had gained sufficient support from her father and the Scar military that she was safe from the pretender's malevolent scheming. It was a bitter pill for the pretender to swallow, and that made Arjin all the happier. One day she might reveal all this to Dar-Lee, should circumstances change. But lives were complicated and personal histories were not to be shared too hastily, so this day she would keep her story to herself. It was not the time or place for anything quite so intimate yet. "My name is Ajin Dyamfir," she said. "I am a princess of the Scar people." Her words hung in the cool silence of the pre-dawn darkness, joining shadows that rippled and shivered with changes of light as clouds passed across the moon. Even with a sword point at her throat, Ajin felt no fear or panic. Although Dali did not yet fully understand it, she sensed there was a bond between them. He would not hurt her, nor would she hurt him. They had crossed paths 3 times now, and once she had held his life in her hands, as he now held her life in his. To her way of thinking, they were warriors of equal stature, and she could not believe he would kill her while she was helpless and fully aware of how recently she had spared him.
"I heard your name inside the keep," he said. "I heard them call out, Ajin, Ajin. A victory cry, I'm guessing.
But it was really a massacre, wasn't it? A slaughter." He shook his head in disgust.
"How do you know my name?"
"From my penetrator, Koldre. You know him as Kassan."
"I know him. And if I find him alive, I will remedy the situation immediately. All the druids of Paranor are dead because of him."
She shrugged.
"And all my brave Scar soldiers are dead, too."
"Is there supposed to balance out? I suppose you think so. Should I mention the druids and the troll guards and crew your airship destroyed?
Or I, the 2 Scar airships you destroyed first?"
For a minute, neither spoke. Then she gave him a questioning look.
"The woman, the female druid. She was special to you, wasn't she?"
He hesitated before nodding.
"Once."
He looked as if he might say something more, but then he went still again.
"And are you responsible for what happened in the keep?" she pressed. "Was that your doing? Was it you who freed that thing inside the walls, that monster and its poisonous mist, so it could feed on my soldiers?"
He shook his head, a dark look shading his expression.
"That was another's choice. But what was the point of any of it? You killed all of us, we killed all of you. Now everyone's dead, and all for nothing.
Not from where I'm standing. Paranor was our greatest threat, so we had to destroy it, and the druids. Now Paranor is gone, and I will not mourn it or its residents."
"No, I don't suppose you will."
He gave her a none too gentle push.
"Move back into the trees, so we aren't standing out in the open in case someone else from your little band of cutthroats survived. And don't even think about trying to run."
She walked into the forest, back where the darkness was so complete she could see almost nothing, the sword point prodding her along, removing her from any hope of finding help. The trees closed about her, Paranor's moonlit rise disappeared, and she was alone with the blade.
"What do you intend to do with me?"
she asked, once he had found a place he liked and brought them to a halt.
"I'm not sure, princess. Maybe ransom you? Maybe use you as bait to draw out that traitor who gave up the keep? Maybe I'll just let you wander for a bit."
"Could you at least give me some space to breathe? Take your sword away from my throat. I promise not to run."
"Oh, please. You think I should trust you after what you've done? How foolish would that be?"
She could hear the disgust in his voice. It made her smile.
"Would you at least stop calling me princess? My given name is Ajin. Call me that."
"Fine, I'll call you Ajin. But I still don't trust you."
"You know the Scar won't ransom me, don't you? Even my father, were he here, wouldn't ransom me. In spite of who I am, it isn't the way we do things."
"Then maybe I should just kill you, since you're so useless otherwise."
"Don't be ridiculous. You would never do that. Why don't you try telling me what I can do to put things right? Maybe we can reach an accord."
She heard his soft laugh.
"An accord? Oh, well, that's different. I didn't realize you could bring the dead back to life, or return the keep from wherever it's been sent."
The blade shoved her up against a tree trunk. His sword shifted so that the edge was pressed against her throat.
"Where are you from?
And why are you here? In the deep stillness of their forest concealment, she told him the details of the story behind the Scar invasion, how their own land grew barren with an increase in severe cold and the coming of an endless winter, how their crops died and food and water grew scarce, how everything changed so quickly, how life became intolerable.
The damage to our people is unimaginable. We are dying, our numbers reduced from millions to thousands. Our most vulnerable, our children, our old and sick, those weakened already from thirst or hunger, die every day. I have watched people I have known all my life perish. I watched my nurse and my favorite childhood playmates die, my dogs, my soldiers.
Her words were bitter, her voice harsh.
It is the same everywhere, all throughout Eurodia, and in all of the other countries on the continent. Picture, if you will, whole populations who hunker down against the bitter winter and wait only to die. Without food and water, without warmth against the cold, what else is there to do? The weather changes are irreversible. The cold is deepening. Even the southernmost lands of Eurodia are beginning to feel its bite.
She paused.
I had a younger sister. She's gone now, too. I tried to save her. I did everything I could think to do. When I wasn't in the field, I was sitting right beside her. I bathed and fed her and saw her through what I thought was the worst of it. But she had always been fragile. The sickness returned quickly enough. She developed a pox that covered her face and hands. She pleaded with me, begging for relief, when I saw there was no hope. And she was gasping for each breath and straining against the pain. I placed a pillow over her face and let her slip away.
She paused, her eyes fixing on him.
When there is nowhere left to go and nowhere to stay, what do you do? I went to my father and begged him to send ships to search out distant lands in which we could make a new home. He did so, and our scouts found yours. We stole your airships and used their designs to build our own. Aquaswifts, we call them. Waters drawn from the oceans of our homeland and treated with chemicals power them. Aquaswifts are bigger and faster than your vessels. Our spies study you for 2 entire years here in your midst, and you never knew. Coldray did most of the work. He is my penetrator, my personal advance scout. He compiled information and sent it back for my father and his counselors. We knew everything about you before my father ordered me to come here with our advance force to prepare the way for the larger invasion. We knew you could be conquered. We know all your weaknesses.
Or you think you do, anyway.
Her captor's response was laced with scorn. She shrugged.
We know enough to take advantage, as you have just seen. You are a nation of many different races and peoples and governments, and you lack a central ruling power. You are fragmented, and thus you are vulnerable. All you really have is your magic, and most of that was concentrated in the druids. Without them, you cannot vanish at will, as we can. You cannot create images to fool your enemies into attacking empty air.
So you decided to eliminate them. You found a way into the keep.
With the aid of one of your own. A druid betrayed you.
She saw recognition in his eyes.
Plaisir Port?
He asked quickly.
Does it matter now?
It might, because she is still alive. I saw her afterward, when the Guardian was set loose. She was the one who sent Paranor into limbo.
She's dangerous, Arjun.
You might live to regret leaving her alive.
Arjun shrugged.
The end result is what matters. The demise of the druids allows us to stop worrying about anyone using magic to oppose us. Now you must rely on your federation's rudimentary sciences and inefficient weapons to resist us, and we will destroy you.
To her surprise, he smiled.
It sounds like you think this might be easy. Just walk right over us, cast us aside, settle in and claim your new home. How long do you think it will take? A week or two?
I don't fool myself into believing it will be that easy. I am a seasoned commander, and I have fought and won many battles. I know what it takes to subdue a population. I know the time required and the costs that must be paid. I am prepared for all of it."
He gave a tired sigh.
"You seem awfully young for someone so bloodthirsty."
Her chin came up, and her gaze found his and held it.
"I have not been young since I was 12 years old, and watched my father banish my mother and her replacement begin to plot against me. Do not make the mistake of underestimating me."
"I would never do that," he replied. "Though I am sorry for your past."
"Do not be. I need no one's pity. I have made my own way in the world for this long, and I will continue to do so. You should worry for yourself. Why not talk to me about an agreement that will allow you to stay alive?"
"I'm not the one with a sword at my throat."
"But you were once, weren't you?
And not so long ago."
He stared at her, his face a mix of emotions. She had touched a nerve, reminding him of how she had held him pinned on a cliffside, and then let him live. She might have been better off killing him, although she didn't think so. It had not felt right to kill one so brave and so loyal to his friends. It had not felt right to kill him when he was so helpless. She saw that he remembered. Could she use it against him now?
"I think you must let me go, Dali," she said abruptly. "You must do for me what I did for you. You must set me free."
He shook his head.
"That would be a very bad idea, princess."
"Arjun."
"Arjun," he corrected. "I would very quickly go from being your captor to being your captive. And I already told you how I feel about that."
"Then be captive to my heart," she thought suddenly, impulsively. The thought, exciting and forbidden.
She could not deny how real and present her attraction to him was, how much it was a true measure of feelings she did not yet fully understand. But it had no place in what was happening now, so she shrugged it away.
"I don't want to be your captive," she said, "but I would have you be mine, once you realize there is no hope for you in the coming struggle. I have already saved your life once, and would do so again. At some point, you will accept this and come to me. When you do, I will be waiting."
He stared at her in bemusement, and she reached up and gently pushed the sword blade away from her throat.
"You don't intend to use this, so why threaten me with it? I am standing before you because I want to, because I want you to understand my cause and to understand me. We are alike, you and I. I respect you, and I think you respect me, too. We fight for what we believe in, but we do so with as much honor as we can manage. We share a code of conduct and a mutual admiration for loyalty and courage. We are not so different as it might seem."
"Different enough. When you keep advancing your plans for conquest, I would never do what you were doing."
"Wouldn't you?"
She cocked an eyebrow and took a step toward him. She was standing so close they were almost touching again. She felt the urge to reach out for him.
"If your land was dying, and your people with it, would you not do whatever it took to save them? Even if it meant fighting to secure a place for them in another inhabitable land?"
She could see the uncertainty in his eyes.
"You cannot know until you are faced with the situation. One day you might be."
She reached out and put her hands on his shoulders. It was a bold gesture, and she could see confusion mirrored in his expression.
"You may continue to think us different, if you wish. But we are not Dali, and never will be. I don't know how this conflict will end. I don't know that either of us will survive it. But I do believe that, in ways neither of us yet understand, our fates are joined."
She reached up from his shoulders to his face and brought it down to hers. On impulse, she kissed him on the lips, a slow brushing, followed by a hard press. She felt him resist, but only for a moment.
"You owe me my freedom," she said, releasing him and stepping back. "So I am taking it. I will not tell any of my people that I saw you, I will not reveal that you are here. Only you and I will know we shared this meeting."
She stepped past him, and he turned to watch as she walked away. A handful of steps farther on, she looked back.
"I will miss you, Blade of Paranor, but we will meet again. Another time, another place, and very soon, I think. Look for me."
He shook his head, almost as if he couldn't quite believe what he was allowing to happen.
"We are even now, Arjun the Amphir. If I catch you again, I will not be so quick to let you go."
Her smile was dazzling.
"Nor I you."
And then, as if to taunt him, she vanished. 2. Cauldray lay in a crumpled heap just beyond the space where Paranor had stood not an hour earlier, oblivious to his surroundings. A heavy chunk of stone, broken free in the cataclysmic destruction of the Scar advance force, had struck him on the head and left him in the path of the swiftly spreading green mist and the creature that it shrouded. He realized it was coming for him and knew he should bolt for safety. He could hear the screams intensifying behind him. He could see the wicked glow spreading through the hallways and into the rooms of the keep, killing everyone it touched. He remembered seeing some of his fellow Scar turn back, nevertheless, reacting instinctively to the shrieks and cries of their fellow soldiers, intending to help friends and comrades. But their efforts had been futile, and they had paid the price for their foolish bravery. Every last one of them was savaged by the horror that hunted them down. There was no standing against such monstrous magic, no device or weapon the Scar possessed that could stop it. Courage for a reason was one thing, but blind, reckless bravery was another. Cauldray had his faults and occasional lack of good judgment, but throwing away his life had never been among them. Yet his memories of what he had witnessed before the stone felled him remained hazy. He had no idea how he had gotten clear of the keep, or even why he was still alive. Nor did it matter. Not so long as he slept, careless and unknowing. But then, suddenly, he was awake, shocked back to consciousness by the memory of lying next to a young girl in her bed beneath coverings turning red with her blood. The knife was in his hand, and he kept stabbing her over and over again, and all the while she watched him, smiling with trust and love, attaching no blame to him, even though it was his hand that killed her.
"Cassan," she whispered.
He sat up with a gasp. The sudden movement made his head spin, and he lowered it between his legs and retched. The dream fragmented, and the night closed about him. He was outside, in the cool air, beyond the walls of Paranor, sitting in a patch of grass with trees to his left and empty space to his right. He turned his head to view the latter, sensing something wrong with it. And then he remembered that this was where the keep had been. It was gone now. He blinked in disbelief, closed his eyes tightly, and looked again. Still gone. Everything was gone. Figures surrounded him, voices speaking urgently to him in the Scar tongue, asking how he was, if he had suffered any injuries besides the one to his head, if he could see properly. He shook his head automatically, brushing them off, not even sure exactly what they were talking about. Then he became aware of the hammering pain that ratcheted through his skull, spearing downward through his neck to his shoulders in steady waves. He reached up to touch the source of the injury, and found a compress tied in place. Something had struck him hard enough to open a wound that had bled down the side of his face and onto his shoulder. He could feel the stickiness of freshly crusted blood and smell its coppery scent. He glanced down and found his druid robes stained red. But the rest of his body seemed intact.
"Help me up," he ordered,
and arms reached down to take hold of him and lift him to his feet. A wave of dizziness and fresh pain nearly felled him a second time, but he managed to keep his feet, waiting for it to pass. He glanced again at the vast open space where Paranor had stood, just to be sure.
"What happened to it?"
he asked the men about him. There were only five. Several of them shrugged. One said,
"It just disappeared. Right after we got you through the gates of the outer wall and out here. Gone. Just like that.
Coldray stared at him.
Is this all of us that's left? All that got out?
The men nodded, stone-faced. Only one even bothered to look at him.
Arjin?
He asked quickly, remembering he had left her there.
The princess?
Gone,
one said.
Gone? What do you mean, gone? She can't be gone. Did you look for her? Did you search?
Penetrator, it was all we could do to make it this far. Bringing you out took everything we had left. Most of us are injured, some badly. If she were here, she could find us easily enough.
He shook his head.
She's dead.
Coldray went numb and cold. He turned his head to hide his tears, looking over to where the fortress had been.
He refused to believe it. Arjin was not gone. She couldn't be.
He wiped at his face with his sleeve.
Arjin the Amphir was invincible. She could not be killed.
Others among them, yes. They were Scar and warriors. Death came frequently and never wandered far from where they stood, always hiding in the shadows, always waiting to leap out. But never for Arjin. Arjin was different.
Yet he understood that these feelings were unique to him. To others she was flesh and blood, like all Scar, and she could be killed as easily.
He saw her differently, because he was in love with her, and he wanted her to be alive because he couldn't imagine a life without her.
Arjin!
His body shook involuntarily, and he stalked away to be alone with his grief. The others knew enough to let him be. He stood apart in the darkness until the tears and the sobbing stopped, and he was himself again. But the loss of Arjin the Amphir was about more than just his personal suffering. She was the heart and soul of their invasion efforts, of everything they had given up to find a new land for their endangered people. She was the light that guided them and gave them their hope, to have come so far and accomplished so much, only to lose the one member of the advance force they could not afford to lose— was inconceivable. He found himself thinking back over the weeks and months and years that had led to this moment. He had spent 2 long years living in this foreign land before standing on the shores of the tide race to greet the Scar fleet as it landed at the far northern edge of the Charnel Mountains. He had spent 2 long years preparing the way for this invasion. He had travelled widely and mapped the 4 lands thoroughly. He had recorded any relevant observations on the characteristics of its races, the locations and designs of its cities and towns, the workings and proclivities of its governments. He had determined its strengths and weaknesses. He had cultivated various pliable government officials who would prove useful later. And all the while, he considered where the Scar should strike first, where next— what sorts of obstacles presented the greatest dangers, which peoples would fight hardest and be most difficult to overcome, and which would be most likely to see the futility of fighting and simply concede the battle before it was joined. Coldray had done this many times before in the countries of Eurodia, the continent that lay closest to the island home of the Scar. His official designation was Penetrator, a scout, spy, assassin, and whatever else he needed to be, but mostly just a planner of ways to break down any form of resistance. Arjin the Amphir relied on him as on no other, to provide her with crucial information and advice on her potential conquests. She had always trusted in the validity and thoroughness of his assessments, and he had never disappointed her. In return, she had paid him special attention— a reward for his services. She had given him access to her as she did to few others. He found her attentions and reliance on him flattering, and he found her, on a personal level, utterly irresistible. Yet resist her he must if he valued his head. Everything was strictly business between Arjin and her penetrator, in spite of his desire for something more. Coldray and those few he had chosen to serve him as guards and aides had come to the Fourlands in traditional sailing vessels shortly after the Scar had determined it was necessary to find a new land to call home. They had crossed the vast blue expanse of the tide race in the old way, unaware of the existence of airships. Necessity was the mother of risk-taking, so you did what you had to, no matter the danger. What might lie on the far side of the ocean was unknown. But the Skaa believed that other countries must exist beyond those waters, and that other peoples must have survived the great wars that had destroyed the old world. It had been a revelation to find the extent of the opportunities this new land afforded. Coldray was quick to recognize that this was where the Skaa were meant to be. Stealing the secrets of the airships was easy enough, and within a year the Skaa had built their fleet of aquaswifts and set about crossing the tide race, not by navigating upon its waters as Cole and his crew had done, but by flying over them. As penetrator, it advised Arjin and the king to send only an advance force to begin with, to test the strength of those they sought to overcome. He had further concluded that the size of the country they were invading would prove a disadvantage to a larger force. A smaller, swifter, more mobile army would have better success and might just be strong enough to gain a foothold that would allow the larger army to cross and begin the greater task of carving out sufficient space for the bulk of their people to begin a new life. His advice had been heeded, and the army Arjin had brought to the Forelands had advanced to the fringes of the barren country belonging to the Korax Trolls, a tribe that he found to be particularly barbaric and warlike, and not much liked by the other tribes. He knew the Korax would attempt to drive them out, but the Skaa always chose a strong adversary at the start to set a persuasive example. So the Korax would attack, thinking them weak and foolish to intrude, thinking victory over such a soft-skinned people would come easily and swiftly. And the inevitable Skaa victory would be a valuable lesson to any who might think the same way. As expected, the Korax had massed in force within a week's time, coming directly for the Skaa. And the Skaa had formed their lines, pointed their weapons toward the Korax, and waited. The Korax were eager to comply, but the battle they got was not the one they were expecting. Instead, it was a massacre. The traditional Korax attack relied on brute force and a reckless disregard for personal safety to overwhelm and crush its opponents. It was a strategy that had always worked for them before. Strike hard, give no ground, show no mercy. It should have worked here, had they been facing anyone other than the Skaa. The Korax had hammered into the invaders' lines with all the fury and bloodlust that had destroyed so many other armies, fully expecting that this battle would end in the same way. But the Skaa had simply waited for them to come, standing perfectly still in their precise but loosely formed ranks. Those in the front carried spears, 8-foot poles with hafts of pale ash, smooth, iron-tipped heads affixed to one end, and hand grips carved into the wood near the other. Those in the rear ranks bore short swords, blades of hammered steel with the surface dulled so that no light reflected, balanced and easily manoeuvrable in combat. When the Korax were within 15 feet, previously designated ranks of Skaa soldiers utilized that part of their genetic makeup that allowed for it, and one by one began to disappear. A curious shimmer rippled all along their lines, and it was suddenly unclear to the Korax what was happening. And then, in another instant, whole ranks were not there at all. Only half of those who had been clearly visible moments before now remained, and their bodies were shimmering too. There was a ghostliness about them, as if they were formed not of flesh and blood, but of smoke and mirrors. Although the trolls could not see what was happening, those Skaa soldiers who had disappeared had shifted their lines left and right, to come at their attackers from the flanks in a pincer movement. The Korax experienced a few quick moments of confusion as they surged to the attack, closing on the Skaa who remained visible, and then they were being slaughtered. Real sword blades and spear points were skewering and slashing the Korax from both sides, in places where no one seemed to be, and there was nothing the trolls could do to protect themselves. They tried to fight back, but they couldn't find their opponents. All they could see before them were empty images. The Skaa were gone. Their bodies become no more than air. The Korax had fought on, anyway, almost to the last troll, because this was all they knew how to do. But it had been hopeless, and they had died, still not knowing what had happened. Even those who sought mercy, falling to their knees in abject surrender, had been slaughtered. Only those who had remained in their village were spared, the old, the infirm, and the young, allowed to live so they could carry word to other tribes in other places about what had happened. Once it was known what the Scar could do, the other troll tribes would be more willing to listen to reason. The Scar army could then bypass these tribes and move down into the borderlands and the more valuable prizes that lay to the south, east, and west. The Scar had left the bodies of the dead on the field of battle to rot, refusing them burial or even the flames of a pyre to send them to whatever afterlife they believed in. Their kin and friends were not allowed to claim them. They would be ghosts abroad in the land, their spirits left to wander aimlessly, their history lost with their passing. This was the fate that awaited all those who chose to stand against the Scar. This was power beyond anything those who inhabited the four lands had witnessed before, and they needed to respect how formidable the Scar were. Coldray had known the impact this massacre would have. After all, he had helped develop this approach. His was a long and storied legacy. He was known throughout the countries of Eurodia, and coming to the Four Lands had given him the chance to further build his reputation, to test himself against men and women who were ignorant of his existence. He had relished the opportunity, coveted the challenge. In the conquering of the Four Lands he would gain new respect, and perhaps elevate himself further in Arjin's eyes. Yet he understood the odds against fulfilling those ambitions. Any personal involvement with a princess had always been enormously complicated. A dozen years her senior, and of common blood, he was not an ideal match by any measure. In fact, there was no reason for the king even to consider him as a son-in-law. None of this was helped by the fact that Arjin did not see him as he saw her. But he also understood you never got anything in this life by deciding you couldn't have it, so he had continued to dream, determined he would find a way. Now the dreaming was over. Now she was dead, and there could never be a way. It was exactly as this dark realization left him bereft that he heard gasps of surprise from a few of those who had hauled him from the keep to safety, and when Coldray turned around to look, Arjin D'Amphir was walking toward him. That Arjin had been able to escape from Dali was something of a surprise. Certainly she had done everything she could to persuade him it was the right thing to do, but it was still almost impossible for her to believe. It told her something about him that left her breathless with need. Here was a man, a warrior without peer, who was secure enough in his own skin to let a woman dictate his fate. One who placed respect and the settlement of personal debts above fears that it would cost him something down the line. Few men she had known would have been able to do this, but for the Blade of Paranor it had been no problem at all. She thought again about how he had fought for the lives of the two druids on the grasslands west of the Channels when the Scar had attacked them. Coming over the side of his warship so swiftly and charging to their rescue, throwing himself into a battle that he must have known he could not win, and still managing to save his female companion, nearly escaping with her into the mountains with flying skills that matched her own, downing two of her airships, and very nearly downing hers as well. It excited her all over again, just thinking about it, and she found herself smiling in spite of the circumstances. Then her smile vanished, washed away by her realization of the darker realities. Yes, the keep and its druids were gone, but she had planned to make a present of the building and its treasures to her father, and now that was impossible. Most of her advance force, perhaps all, Coldray included, was likely dead, destroyed by the creature that lived in the greenish mist. It was a hard, painful reward for all of their efforts, and she could only hope that it provided an example to the people of the Four Lands, showing them what the Scar were prepared to do in order to make a home here. She circled the perimeter of the grounds on which Paranor had rested, unwilling to step again onto that treacherous soil without a very good reason. She trudged through the darkness, searching for Scar survivors, but found no one. In the surrounding forests, the birds and animals had begun to communicate again as they went about their lives with the coming of morning. Insects buzzed her heated face, and in the sky the diminished moon hung low against the horizon while the stars were beginning to fade again in the lightening sky. Morning was less than an hour away. She had wandered along the perimeter of perhaps half of the keep's barren grounds when she found the ragged little band of survivors, and felt a small leap of joy. Even better, there was Cole, standing off by himself, staring at nothing. When the cries of the others alerted him to her presence, and he turned and saw her, he raced for her, folding her in his arms with such happiness that she felt compelled to give him silent permission to touch her in familiar fashion this once.
"I thought you were dead," he whispered, crushing her against him. "That was what they said. But I knew it wasn't so."
"Yes, but it will be if you don't let me breathe soon," she complained.
He released her at once and stepped back.
"Forgive me."
"For what?"
She gripped his arms to hold him in place.
"For being glad to see me alive? For letting your usual cold and tightly wound emotions get the better of you?"
She reached up to touch his cheek.
"My brave Cole."
Without pausing to measure his reaction, she released him and walked over to the other men. She took each by the hand, praising him for his courage and determination, congratulating him on escaping a dangerous trap and living to celebrate the victory they had achieved over the druids and their magic. The men nodded wordlessly or offered muted words of thanks, simultaneously embarrassed and proud, hauling their battered bodies upright long enough to face her and be recognized. She knew they loved her, worshipped her in some instances. She knew their loyalty was unquestionable. She spoke to each of them by name. Her soldiers had all been with her a long time, and before she was finished, she found herself weeping for all the ones who were no longer there. As she was finishing, she caught sight of Cole watching her from one side, his expression one of lingering disbelief and joy, as if he was making sure she was real and not a ghost. A complex man, Cole Drey. In looks, he was unexceptional. Of medium height, with a dark complexion and brown hair and eyes, where most Skaar were tall and fair-skinned with blue eyes and blonde hair. He was also not one to stand in the ranks and engage in hand-to-hand combat as she did. He was not a believer in the value of honour and glory, of proving courage through battles, of risking all for the sake of companions and country. He thought himself above all that, a shade more clever, a twist more intelligent. But this did not mean he was a timid man, or a coward. He was a formidable opponent when he needed to be. He had killed other men without compunction, and some of them for her. But he was not fashioned in the traditional Skaar mould, and he was aware that it set him apart. To a very great extent it was what defined him, which was what made him so valuable to her. A penetrator must be a chameleon, able to think independently from those around him while remaining in the background, an unremarkable presence. He must have sharp eyes and quick wits, and a good memory. He must be bold, but not reckless. She could go on, but all that mattered was how well Cole Drey had served her in this capacity, and how closely their fortunes were tied. Again and again, the two of them had led the way for the Skaar nation as they expanded their empire into Eurodia, claiming country after country for their king. Even if her upbringing had required more of her than his had of him, and even if he longed to bed and perhaps one day to wed her, he did not let this interfere with the job he had been given to do.
"Come," she called to him, beckoning him over to join the others. "We need two stretchers and four pairs of hands to carry Ferpas and Ananlor back to the airship. The rest of the advance force will need to be told what's happened before we set out again. Cole, set our brave soldiers to their tasks."
And Cole Drey, his hopes renewed, jumped to obey. 3. Dali stood in a dappled landscape of shadows and moonlight and watched Arjun D'Amphir walk away. On the one hand, he knew it was foolish for him to allow her to leave. She was the commander of a foreign incursion into the Four Lands, the leader of a force that had defeated two different troll tribes and destroyed virtually the entire Fourth Druid Order. She was a large part of the reason Paranor had been sent from the Four Lands into a limbo existence, trapping Driska Ark, the last honourable druid, inside. Yet now he had set her free to return to what remained of her army and continue on with her plans for the Four Lands, whatever they happened to be. On the other hand,
What was he supposed to do with her if he didn't let her go?
His most urgent need was to find and retrieve Driska Ark from within Paranor and get him back into the Four Lands to help deal with both the Skaar invasion and Clesia Pors, and there was little Arjyn Dyamfyr could do to help with this. She would be a distraction and a burden if he tried to keep her a prisoner. He would have to lock her up somewhere and find someone to keep an eye on her, since it was obvious he could hardly haul her along with him. Nor did he think she was a bargaining chip with the Skaar. She was probably right about how they would react if he tried to make her one. It didn't take much to realize he was a little short of choices, and his immediate efforts to help Driska were what really mattered, even though he knew she was dangerous, an enemy of the Four Lands who would eventually come looking for him again. Besides, he also knew she was right about his obligation to her. She was owed her freedom. She had done as much for him, giving him back his life, when she could have snuffed it out. She talked about honour and courage as if they were a moral code she believed in, and from what he had seen of her actions, it appeared she did. He wasn't entirely comfortable admitting it, but he found that he admired her. Maybe even more than admired her. He watched her until she was out of sight, then continued watching for a few minutes more, trying to understand his behaviour. When you felt closer to a young woman who had just killed virtually every last druid you had sworn to protect than you did to the druids themselves, it suggested you had your priorities mixed up, or maybe your sense of loyalty. But he didn't think so. The truth was that, in retrospect, he really did admire her more than he had admired most of them. He shook his head at himself, still lost in his thoughts, until he remembered what he was supposed to be doing. Arjyn had said she would not alert any other Skaar survivors to his presence, but standing around to find out if she meant it did not seem wise. With a last glance at the empty ground where Paranor had stood not 2 hours ago, he sheathed his sword, turned around, and walked away. His plans for helping Driska were already forming in his head. If things had been different, he would have sought out Clesia Pors. But having watched her dispatch the keep to parts unknown, presumably knowing Driska was still inside, he was pretty sure she was unlikely to help. Driska had not trusted her, and in the end his doubts had proved well-founded. It was clear enough that Clesia had betrayed him, and had plans of her own regarding the Druid Order, if there was ever to be another, along with any future return of Paranor. How she would manage all this he had no idea, nor did it matter just now. What he needed to know was this. How was he supposed to get Driska Ark back into the Four Lands when, save for the Sword of Lee, he did not have any magic to call upon? He could only think of one person who might help, and that was Tasha. She wasn't yet a druid, but she was a druid's student. She had studied under Driska, and she had powerful magic of her own, as heir to the iconic wish song that had served so many druid allies in the past, including members of his own family. If anyone could find a way to help Driska, it would be her. But first he had to find out where she was. He knew where she was going. She had told him that much. But whether she was already there, still on her way, or finished and headed back to Emberon was unclear. At least as things stood just now. So things would have to change. He reached Driska's little two-man and climbed aboard, powering up the diapson crystals and opening the pass tubes. He wasted no time giving further thought to his decision. Time was something he did not have to waste, and he had a long flight ahead. As Dar-Lee departed, dawn was beginning to brighten the edges of the eastern horizon from behind the jagged peaks of the Dragon's Teeth, and Arjyn Dyamfyr was standing watch over Khol Drae and the 5 other surviving soldiers from 100 who had gone into the keep. She had ordered them to move north from the battleground and deep into the woods, where they would be hidden from view before she'd let them sleep. When they woke, she would dispatch the strongest of them to find the Aquaswift they had flown in on and bring it back. It was much farther away than she would have liked, kept well away from druid eyes on their arrival, so there was no chance of it being seen. For now they all needed rest. But for her, sleep would not come, so she had risen and gone off to sit by herself. Her thoughts should have been full of what to do next,
with virtually the whole of the attack force she had brought to Paranor destroyed, but instead all she could think of was Dali. She was well and truly smitten. She would not deny it. Could not, in point of fact, do so honestly. She was attracted to him as she had not been attracted to another man, ever. She had experienced her share of crushes and lovers, but they had come and gone, leaving virtually no impression. Yet in their three brief encounters, Dar had imprinted himself on her heart, despite the inescapable truth that they were more enemies than friends. It was stranger than strange, but it was exciting, too. Dali was everything she admired in a man, and she intended to have him, one way or another. She was not so foolish as to think she could make this happen now. There were too many uncertainties and unexpected turns waiting ahead, and no amount of preparation would ever be sufficient. At the end of the day, she and Dali were on opposite sides of a conflict that threatened to engulf the whole of the Four Lands. Time and circumstance would have to change that, but she was fully convinced it could happen. This was the nature of fate. She just had to be patient. She had to trust that she would be given her chances and that when she would respond in the best way possible. But whatever future there was for the Blade and herself, it waited somewhere down the road, and for now she had other concerns she must deal with. With the Druids dead and Paranor lost, she needed to redefine her goals for the Four Lands. The size of her original command of 1,000 soldiers was reduced, but still sufficient for her to act. Nevertheless, the first thing she had to do upon rejoining those she had left behind in the primary camp farther north was to convince them, down to the last soldier, that what had happened to the others not only had not been her fault, but also had not been preventable. If they believed she had acted recklessly in attacking Paranor directly, she would lose control of her soldiers, she would lose their trust and their belief in her. And that would be the end of everything. She would return home in disgrace, a failure her quick-to-judge father might well use to determine she was both useless and expendable. But her thoughts of such possibilities quickly faded, as Coldray joined her moments later, coming up silently and sitting beside her without speaking. Because she was used to having him close at hand, and ready to offer advice in situations where she would never have suffered the presence of others, she let him stay. Long minutes passed in silence. Then she looked over at him and waited until he was looking back. "You needn't sit with me, Coldray," she said. "I am well enough by myself." His smile was wan. "I will leave if you wish, princess." She shook her head. "I don't wish it. You are welcome to stay, but you must call me by my given name. We are alone now." "As you wish, Arjin." His face was comforting in its familiarity. Calm and introspective, a reassurance. She had thought now and again about accepting him as more than her penetrator and sometime confidant. She could hardly avoid it, given their proximity during their travels. But she could never quite make herself believe this was a good idea. She sensed that if she took that extra step, it would change their relationship. And she didn't want that. Besides, she valued him for his advice and his loyalty, not for his potential as a bedmate. However he saw things, she did not see a future between them that would allow for more. "We've lost everything," she said, after a few further moments of silence. "Paranor, its magic, the druids, and our ability to use it all to bargain with. We've let it slip through our fingers by being inattentive and complacent. I should have done more to secure it. I should have been better prepared for a punitive response." Coldray shook his head. "What could you have done? How could you have foretold any of it? There was no way to prepare for what happened. No way to stop that thing from coming out and destroying us. We were helpless against it. That is a poor excuse. I am to blame. I overreached." "It could be argued that way," he agreed. "But those who do not dare do not achieve. You took a chance and you almost succeeded. Your father will be proud of you." She snorted. "My father will skin me alive." "You destroyed the entire Druid Order, Arjin." He was leaning close, his face intense. "You eliminated the single most dangerous threat to our success in claiming these lands.
No one else has the strength or means to stand against us, and I should know. I've spent 2 years among these people. With the druids gone, there is no other power that can prevent us from taking what we want, not even the elves, and the four lands are too divided to unite as they should.
She felt herself go calm. He was right, of course. She had done what he claimed, and half a loaf was always better than none. She only needed to find a way to reimagine a Scar victory in the aftermath of these events. She only needed to find a new path for achieving what her people expected.
"You have to let go of your guilt," Kol added a moment later.
She smiled.
"It would surprise you, Kol Dre, to know what else I probably have to let go of," she thought. "But that information is for me alone." "I know," she said instead.
He heard something in the tone of her voice and lowered his gaze deferentially, as if he knew he had overstepped. She fought back a surge of satisfaction.
"Come now. We have more pressing concerns to occupy our attention. Do you have a plan for addressing those concerns?" he asked.
She gave him a brief nod.
"I'm working on it."
They said nothing to each other for a time afterward. Kol Dre wanted to pursue the matter, but he knew it was better to just let her be. She was looking off into the morning, her thoughts clearly elsewhere. He had noticed it before when he came over to sit with her. She didn't look particularly troubled by whatever was drawing her attention. Rather, she looked almost pensive. An air of calm infused her countenance, defined her posture and layered her gestures. She might be displeased with other things, the loss of Paranor, the deaths of almost 100 of her best soldiers, but something besides these seemingly pressing concerns was preoccupying her.
"Where will we go once we leave here?" he said finally.
"What?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to disturb you."
"You didn't. I was simply thinking about something else."
"Indeed. I asked where you think we would go after we leave Paranor."
She stared at him as if she didn't understand.
"We return to the advance force and go on."
"Go on where?" A flicker of irritation lit in her eyes.
"Why don't you tell me, Penetrator? What would your advice be? Where would you have me go?"
"I think it would be unwise to turn back."
"Agreed. The Scar do not retreat.
So we go forward, as you said, perhaps through one of the passes south and out onto the banks of the Myrmidon, and see what sort of response we get."
"That is what you would do? What you would have us do? Advance and wait to see what happens?"
"It has its merits."
"It is a lazy man's game. We need to do more. Why don't we fly to the Federation capital and confront them on their doorstep?"
He shook his head.
"No need. Arishag will come to us. Then we will seek an alliance with Varz."
Keter Varz, Prime Minister of the Federation, a man called Dre had studied and come to understand during his time in the Four Lands. Varz would recognize the value Arjin represented as an ally and come to meet her. He would offer her a partnership, an agreement, one that would give her access to the power her father desired over all the Four Lands. She made a disparaging noise.
"If he did as you suggest, I would not waste time on an alliance. I would face him down as we did the druids and so many others who chose to underestimate us, and then I would destroy him."
Kol Dre paused. Her answer was nonsense. What was going on? She was not thinking clearly, and that was very unlike her.
"The Federation has airships," he pointed out, "many more than we do. They would outnumber us considerably on the ground as well. We might do substantial damage to them, but in the end we would be the ones destroyed."
She made a dismissive gesture.
"Do you think I don't know this? But we must do something to keep them at bay until the king arrives with the main body of our army, and we are no longer so unevenly matched."
"The king," she had said, "not my father." He took note as he replied.
"I would think a meeting of some sort might prove a better choice." "We need to keep them off balance. We need to make them afraid of us. We need to keep them uncertain of what we might do. So we set a trap. We let them send their soldiers and their airships and destroy them before they realize how foolish they are being. Do we not know how to do this? Did we not do this at Rems?"
He nodded slowly, remembering. At Rems, they had discovered that an alliance of Bosch and Zekis was moving against them. This combined force badly outnumbered the Ska, and even with their special abilities it would have been hard to defeat the foes head-on. So